Last fall, the New York Times wrote an article capturing the rapid increase in a certain type of convert to Orthodox Christianity, a conservative, tradition-seeking man who has been introduced to the church by the internet, aka the Orthobro. I'm not used to Orthodox Christianity being, unfortunately in this case, part of the national conversation. But I was really bothered by this. And it's not just Orthodoxy these men are flocking to. It's also Catholicism. And it's a particular vision of the religion that they've come into these churches with. Which is why I want to frame for you today a question that I started asking about 20 years ago. Can a feminist woman be religious? I'll bring it back to where I was at the time when I first asked this question. I was at Oxford on my study abroad, sitting in the Radcliffe camera on the lower level, facing one of the windows that looked out onto Brasenose College, the sky, its typical gray. And I was reading a book about the role of women in the Orthodox Church, a recent ethnography that reintroduced everything that I had felt and seen my whole life. Because I wanted to know if the casual misogyny, the way women didn't have an official role in the church, but did all of the work, if that was something that happened just in my parish or beyond it. At Oxford, I attended the simultaneously Russian and Greek Orthodox Church up Banbury Road. It was octagonal because it was a converted milk barn. And it was by far the most intellectual parish I had ever belonged to. And this was the most observant I would ever be again in my life. I even got to hear Calistos Ware, the Bishop of England and famous convert and theologian, speak. He was incredible. And yet, there was something that didn't sit right. I just didn't feel like I had a place. So that afternoon in the library, I found an answer for why I felt like there was no space for me. Someone else had studied it. And the church as it existed was not budging and creating space for women. The patterns I had seen were the same elsewhere. So that day was when I stopped practicing as I was. But you know, if you're Greek American or from some other diaspora group that is Orthodox Christian in the US, that you can never fully detach yourself from the religion. There's no such thing as being a lapsed Orthodox. And I still find comfort in being in Orthodox churches, in practicing the rituals with other people. And aside from that, a lot of who I am is because of what I was taught there. And that's probably why it especially bothers me when I see any religion being weaponized and twisted. And that's where this episode lands, in the rise of conservative men converting to Orthodox Christianity and Catholicism in droves. Because they believe these religions are inherently masculine and will give them the dominance they think they've lost in American society. So I had to ask an Orthodox theologian that question that had come up for me when I was at Oxford that first time around. Is it possible for a woman to be liberal, progressive, and religious in the United States right now? I got some answers to that question in this conversation with Rachel Condos. Rachel is an Orthodox theologian at Fordham University who has been the vice president of Axia Women, an organization that raises up the voices of Orthodox women in the church. And she's been on the board of St. Phoebe Center for the Deaconess. That is an organization that does advocate to revive the official role of the deaconess in the Orthodox Church. She also studies intersectional theology, and she's a former community organizer and activist. But what really hits you when you talk to Rachel is how brave she is. She is so outspoken. She is not afraid to talk to and talk back to authority in a way that is still respectful. So in this episode of Our Pandora's Box, we're going to dig into what the deal is with the Orthobros and where the space is for women in religion. If you're trying to understand how to deal with religious conservative men in whatever tradition you belong to, and you're trying to find some inspiration and hope, this is an episode you're going to find fascinating. So let's get into it. So I'm excited to have our conversation today.
Like, me I think, too.
I've been I think this is going to be great.
About it.
Yeah, me too. I usually open up the interview by asking people, could you describe yourself in your 20s?
So I should just start by saying I'm in my 30s. I'm 33. And I think I didn't really become a really confident version of myself until my 30s. There was something about like hitting 30 that just like I felt like I could settle in. I've always been like big personality. I was the type of person, I went to karaoke once a week with my friends. Like we had a bar we went to and we did karaoke. And when I was moving to Milwaukee, I brought my parents. And people would come up to them and be like, you're Rachel's parents? Was she a theater kid? And my parents were like, yeah. Everyone's like, who brings their parents to their karaoke bar? But like, just a ham, you know? At the same time, I was definitely like boy crazy. I remember a distinct conversation as I had a full ride for my master's, which is in theology. It's not a thing. And so I'm on a hike with a friend and I'm like lamenting that I have this great news of this full ride. And I'm also like upset because maybe I had just gotten in a breakup or whatever. And my friend had definitely found the guy she was going to marry. And she like holds my hand. And she goes, it'll be your year sometime.
Ooh.
It's like, I was that kind of 20-year-old that like not knowing if I was like had found my marriage partner was more important than the fact that I was about to start doing amazing work or sharing that I was celebrating something like my master's or a promotion. And I look back on that and I'm like, dork, you know, but like, I get it. If someone comes to me and like says that, I'm like, I get it. Especially I'm from the Midwest, right? So we have this like, You go to college, you get married, you have kids. But then on the other hand, I was like highly driven. I was a community organizer in my 20s. I worked on multiple pieces of legislation that made it, for example, in Chicago and Cook County, the county Chicago's in, it's illegal to discriminate for housing on the basis of a criminal record. I helped form that legislation and get it passed. I felt like I wasn't a full person. Like, I was like two halves of a person that had not been like quite stitched together, which I think a lot of my friends felt. I think a lot of people in their 20s feel is just like you're figuring out who you want to be, who you're supposed to be, who you are, all at the same time. And that's actually a lot. And I definitely was going through that in my 20s. I don't know if that makes sense to your experience of your 20s.
It does. I mean, I think I had an idea of what I wanted to do, who I wanted to be. I wanted to be a writer, so I moved overseas to do that and do that research. I was actually engaged for the first time at 30. That did not end up panning out. And so everything I had built up so carefully in my 20s really collapsed in a really epic way.
Oh.
When I was 30, I mean, really novelistic. I mean, I didn't do that on purpose. I couldn't have caused a coup attempt in Turkey, but that's among the events that happened that just spectacularly derailed my life when I turned 30. And so everything I'd built up just very quickly, I took apart and then I had to start over again. But thinking back to my 20s, in a similar way, I was in a bit of an academic path because I did my master's degree. When I went to do it in a month, I knew like, no, I don't want to go on for a PhD. This is actually not the path for me. I felt like I was trying on a lot of things as well as continuing to stay in Turkey because I liked Istanbul so much. And so I was doing everything to be like, okay, what's this next job that's more interesting and pays better and has better people to work with and gives me still time to write? That was the ultimate thing. But then on the end of romantic relationships, I mean, I was in some parts of my life just having fun. And other parts being like, okay, I think I want my person now.
Yeah, I don't think I ever dated for fun until like maybe 29.
Hmm.
Like, I just didn't know that was a thing you could do. I think I knew, but I was like, that's not for me. You know, like I dated someone for 3 years and I really thought we're going to get married. And I'm so glad we're not married, you know, and that's not a dig on this person. This person was not ready to be married. I wasn't ready to be married. I think we were just ready to be the type of people who were ready to be married.
Mm.
It's just such a unique time. I don't regret anything I did in my 20s. But there are decisions I'm glad didn't pan out. For example, I got offered a job working for the Democratic Party in Illinois.
Okay.
And I just sort of like really prayed about this and was like, no, just stick with what you're doing. I'm so glad that like this policy dream I had, that mm-hmm. when I was offered something that would directly work in that, that I had been able to discern that it wasn't the right fit for me. And I'm glad that that didn't pan out. And I'm also glad that I didn't hold what expectations I had. I'm glad I didn't let that become such a sense of obligation that I went through with things I didn't, in my gut, knew were wrong. That I did know in my gut were wrong.
How did you decide to become an Orthodox theologian?
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
I don't think it's crazy. I think it's interesting.
I'm glad you think it's interesting and not like, girl. Sometimes I'm like, my friends should sit me down and host an intervention and be like, girl, like, why are you doing this? But that's on my, just on my days where I'm like really stressed about getting a chapter done or something, not about really the Orthodox part or the theologian part. So I always loved theology. I always loved church until I didn't. I went to a church where I was bullied for being fat. I went to a church where my family was really excluded for being not wealthy. My dad is a computer programmer, so we were hit by the 2001 tech bubble bursting and by 2008. So we weren't a wealthy family. For a long time, we were a paycheck to paycheck household. I distinctly remember, for example, there's this ministry in the Orthodox Church where on Holy Friday, so the Friday before Easter, girls wear like usually all white and they're acting as the myrrh-bearing women, and they will like throw petals over Christ's tomb. I remember one year all the girls who were the myrrh-bearing women got matching little dresses, but they didn't come in my size, and also my parents couldn't afford how expensive they were or the alterations, so we just like went to Old Navy and got an outfit, and then they like made fun of me and pointed out how different I looked and da 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 da, and it was, I almost didn't want to do it, or I would get bullied so bad in Sunday school that I would ask to join the choir instead of go to Sunday school. And so slowly, right, through my teen years, I was just like, I hate this. And I felt bad about hating it because it's like hating a thing you love, you know, like, and not being able to love it despite things that felt external to it. I felt like I should be able to just like love the liturgy even if I can't hang out with any of the people here. I thought I should be able to do that, right? And I couldn't. And it wasn't until I had kind of a spiritual experience my senior year of high school after a cousin of mine passed away that I was like, okay, I need to at least try to get some sustenance from this. So I decided the year I started college to do the opposite of most college students and just go to the Divine Liturgy every Sunday. And I would go and leave. The only days I would stay, one of my great aunts actually went to the parish that I was at, but not often. So if she was there or my uncle was there, right, I would stay and have lunch with them or whatever. And I just fell in love with learning the rituals. I fell in love with having this silent place to myself in the middle of college, having this routine. I went to Marquette in Milwaukee for the first 2 years of college. And I take this theology class and I'm like, whoa, I'm allowed to ask questions about God? Like, I don't have to just, like, take this spoon-fed all those times my priest would say a sermon where I was like, that seems shallow, or I don't know if that's quite right, or all of that. Like, I'm allowed to be like, let's think about this, right? Like, that's a thing. I'm not passive. I can be more active. And so I ended up switching my major to theology, to my parents' dismay. Lots of fights about a theology major. Because we were working class family. I was the first person to go to college. My parents don't know what a theology major is. They're like, you're going to just come out and be unemployed. Like, what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. Be an academic. And my parents like, what does it mean to be an academic? Like, we didn't go to school. Like, there's no jobs. What's happening, right? So I ended up going to Hellenic College for a semester of faith, which you're familiar with because your sister and I were together.
Yeah, she actually just sent me a photo of, let me see if I can pull it up, of that semester. Let's see, let me find it. She dug through quite a bit. Where's so this photo? Funny. And it's an outside photo. I don't know how well you can see this.
Oh my gosh. We were babies. Little babies.
Peak 2010s fashions.
I love it. Peak 2010s fashions. Just for those who maybe don't know, those of us who grew up in the 2010s, we were in college and we would like go out dressed in business casual.
But like a funky business casual.
Really funky. Wear like a bold necklace or like glitter.
The long necklaces, the little vests.
We loved like a play on different lengths. Things,
yes.
But still somehow business casual materials, which is so funny. So I go to Hellenic College and I ended up staying for my last 2 years because they offered me a full ride. And at Hellenic, I almost lost my faith.
Really?
So that's why I'm sharing this, because it was a lot of men who I knew would one day have institutional power just being sexist. Like, I remember one time reporting that a guy had made a Facebook post about how this guy was, imagine a guy like late 30s, early 40s. All the guys on campus, almost all of them are in seminary. All the women on campus, almost all of them are in the undergrad. So you have these grad students trying to date these undergrads because they want to find wives. And not all of them, right? A lot of these guys were very appropriate, very kind. I'm still friends with them, all that. But you have these couple, few, who were like creepers.
And I think we need to take a step back for the audience to define please. These men might be. Right now, I'm like, oh, my God, creepy age gap relationship at that age. Right. Because you have men who are in their 30s. So ostensibly,
yeah,
you have
like
women who are college
people,
age.
Even 25.
Right.
If you're dating an 18, 19 year old freshman college, right. Still creepy. So
but why would they? But let's tell them why they might be doing that.
So for those who aren't familiar with what Hellenic College is, Hellenic College is the undergrad of the Greek Orthodox Seminary in America, which is Hellenic College, Holy Cross Greek Orthodox Seminary. So you have these undergrads at Hellenic College who it's maybe 50-50 men and women. And then the grad school, which is a seminary, which is almost all men. Even when a woman's there, it's almost like not statistically significant. In Orthodoxy, priests are allowed to be married, but they are not allowed to get married as priests. We ordain married men. So what does that distinction mean? It means that men who want to be priests have to be married before they become a priest. So there's this weird thing that happens where you have these guys who are out of undergrad, who are maybe 25, and this whole pool of like women who also are very pious. They want to have a religious experience. They might want to be a priest's wife, not in an instrumentalizing way, but they might see that as part of their vocation serving the church, or at least they're open to it. But you have all these guys incentivized to find wives, these women who are pious, or even if they're not, they love theology. They want to go to Hellenic to be closer to God and Orthodoxy. That mix leads to a lot of weird age gap relationships. And then it also leads to when a guy comes back to seminary in his like late 30s, early 40s, he's surrounded by all these guys in their 20s looking for wives. And maybe he's like, oh, I'm also going to look for a wife. And you're like, no, these girls are 19. So this guy makes this Facebook post. I am 21 max. Okay. So he makes this post that's like, all the pretty girls here are dating someone, or basically they're hoes. He doesn't say that, but he's like, you know, they have loose morals or whatever.
Jeez.
And then the only kind of semi-viable option is this ugly fat girl, and I just don't want to have to settle for some ugly fat girl. And I was like, that's me. I'm the ugly fat girl, right? And I'm like, and I remember like printing this out, because, right, like, you guys, like, this was 2013. Yeah. So I went to the library and I printed it out, which we would just bring a screenshot now. And I remember bringing it in to the dean of students and him like not seeing a problem with this.
Why?
I remember a conversation that might have been this conversation, might have been different. We had it several times when I would talk about men's behavior. Was, you know, it's hard for guys too. They're coming here to study and they just have the stereotype that all they're doing is try to find a wife and get married and not be close to the Lord. And I'm like, look at this Facebook post. This guy is literally talking about a 22-year-old Max, and basically saying, like, I'd settle for the fat, ugly one, but I don't really want to have to. So, God, please send someone who I could date who's not one of these women so I don't have to settle. As if, by the way, that if he deigned to ask me out, I would have gone out with him.
And then there's the bigger problem here, right? That you're highlighting. Exactly. These are guys who are going to have institutional authority. And they're supposed to be guiding their parishes or even further up and making big decisions. And to me, I hear this and I think this guy has some lessons to learn before he's unleashed on the world.
And the fact that I remember that, for example, the way to get to the cafeteria, there was a men's side of the dorm and a women's side. The caf was attached to the women's side. So if you didn't want to have to walk outside in the cold, you had to walk through the women's side of the dorm, our hallway, and into the cafeteria. Or you had to, the top floor of that side was men's, so you had to walk up to the top floor, across, down. So bishops, like old-ass bishops, would come, and the dean of students didn't want to make them walk outside, or whatever dean, or some person in charge of grounds didn't want to make them walk outside. So, oh wait, let me back up. There were times when men and women were allowed to be in each other's sides of the dorm.
Okay.
And times they weren't. And before breakfast was a time they were not. So as the girls, we would walk around like in bras and underwear because we are not feeling threatened by each other. We're just walking to and from the shower in a towel.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's women. Women are like not afraid of our bodies in front of each other. You know, we got our hair up in a towel. I would wear these like itty bitty shorts, but I was just going to it from the bathroom to brush my teeth, right? And all of us were doing this. Then if a bishop was staying and was staying in the dorm for breakfast, instead of making him walk up and down the stairs or go outside, they would unlock our side where we're wearing like towels and just like walk him through as if that wasn't a violation.
Would they warn you before a bishop was coming through?
No, we would ask them, please warn us. Please let us know. Please respect us. And it would happen over and over again. And it basically came to a head when a group of us just kind of freaked out. We basically like yelled the F word at the bishop. We were like, get the F out of here. Why is there a fucking man in here? Right. Like we were just like, we acted like we didn't realize it was a bishop. Like we knew. And we kind of organized.
Because like, he must have been dressed like a bishop.
Yeah, but like we were just like, why is there a man in here? Get the F out of here. We just like acted like we were freaked out. We acted like he was a predator. And I think he was so scandalized that he was like, don't do this. You told us men will not be here during this time.
Right.
So we're acting like a women's community who's comfortable all like singing in the shower, using the bathroom, playing our music, you know, wearing a bra out. Yeah. And you bring a bishop through here. That's inappropriate, right? So several levels of institutional sexism and misogyny and dehumanization, etc. And then I mentioned earlier, I became a community organizer.
Yeah.
And so I was really interested in like the social justice aspect, but here we are with all these guys talking about, like, oh, we love God and our neighbor. And then we'd be walking down the street in Boston and there'd be someone experiencing homelessness. And I would try to give them cash and they'd be like, don't give them cash. It could use that for drugs. They could use that for this. I said, or they could just use it to buy food. Or if you're so concerned, why don't you buy them food? Mm-hmm. And it was just like a disconnect between what it meant to love God and neighbor and how these guys actually acted. Compounded by the institutional reality that the institution barely had any partnerships with, like, local community service orgs. It's mm-hmm. better now at that. So by the time I left Hellenic, I was like, I'm done. I did not go to church probably for 2 years.
Wow.
So how did I become an Orthodox theologian?
After all of that,
I had this sense, and I've had it in my core always, that speaking up is a valid form of worship, is a valid form of community, of church, that argument is part of church. So it felt like I was being left out when the institution was the problem. I was being left out of communion while these guys got to serve communion. And I was like, that's not fair. That's like, why am I punished? Mm-hmm. So I said, I'll be the punishment. No, that's not really what I said. But I think that now.
I like the line, though.
I said, I'm going to come to church. I'm going to be outspoken. I'm going to participate. And I'm going to talk about the issues I was working on, which was homelessness at the time. I'm going to be active. And I ended up deciding to go for my master's. I literally said to myself, I'll apply for theology if it's free. Because I'll end up doing public policy later, and that's not an option for the free program. So I'll just get a second master's I pay for. But if I'm not paying, I'm going to do a passion project. So I start studying theology in my master's. I'm working in my community. I'm going to church, all the stuff. And all the time, I would get questions from Orthodox women. Like, sometimes crazy things, like questions I've gotten asked. Can I have sex on my period? I'm like, do you want to have sex on your period? You know, like, if you want to, then yeah. If you don't, then yeah, you can, but you don't have to. Like, what is, like, there's nothing saying you can't. Why are you asking me this? Just do what you want. Right? And, like, or questions about sexual assault, questions about virginity. Did I lose my virginity if I was assaulted, etc., right? I would get asked these kinds of questions. And I had no plan to do a PhD. It was a terminal degree for me, my master's, right? At the same time, George Floyd had been murdered. And in Milwaukee, where I was living, the community organizers decided they were going to march every day for 365 days. So sometimes the march would be like four people. And so if that was happening, like, I would try to go. Because I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll go for a walk and be with my community. And a lot of people would find out I was getting my master's in theology and they would talk to me about it. And there's nothing like walking and talking to really open up. It's like a real psychological phenomenon that when you're sideways, you open up more. So basically, a group of people found out I was getting my degree as a terminal degree and kind of sat me down and said, like, if you don't get a PhD, we'll have no one safe to ask questions to talk to. We have needed your voice during your master's. And we need your voice after, because you care about us and you're doing theology. That really convinced me to do my PhD. And actually, in the Orthodox theology of ordination, it's not supposed to be that, like, some guy at 12 can decide, I want to be a priest, and then just, like, go to school at 18 and do a 7-year track and become a priest, right? It's supposed to be that a community exists and natural leaders who are trusted are pushed forth by their community toward the path of ordination. Usually they are like, no, no, no. Like, I'm fine just serving my church this way. The community is like, no, like, we think you should step up. And the bishop's like, hey, I've heard from your community, right? And it's supposed to be this hyper-local thing. That doesn't happen, but it's supposed to be. And I really think that doing a PhD for me was like the call to ordination. It was like my community just being like, nah, We know you better than you know yourself. You're doing this. I remember going to some of my feminist professors and them saying, like, you're in a church where you can't get ordained. And your academic work can really matter to people. Giving talks, being a presence, your writing. And it's already happened. I got invited to help lead strategic planning for an Orthodox women's group. They asked me to start with a theological talk. And then the rest of the strategic planning was a reflection on that. Some of the feedback I got was them saying, oh, I wish that we had made the talk public or open to, like, other women in our lives, because my mom was jealous that I got to hear a woman theologian speak because she had never heard one. Or, I really hope we invite you back and other women, because it was amazing to hear a woman talk about theology to women. Like, already just as a PhD student, I've gotten to see the wisdom in the women who lifted me up. Yeah. And the queer people who lifted me up, a lot of queer people. So really, my PhD was me fighting it every step of the way and feeling disillusioned every step of the way. And then having other people say, like, yeah, but your disillusionment speaks to my disillusionment, and your passion and wanting to stay speaks to my passion and wanting to stay. But somehow I have been gifted with the kind of time, the way my brain functions, right? And sort of curiosity and fortitude and life circumstances, right? Financial life circumstances, all these things, to be able to do this. I just love women in the Orthodox Church. I love queer people in the Orthodox Church. And I want to be someone who fights for them, because if you are being abused, you should not feel like you have to stay. And I have never felt like I had to stay Orthodox. Every single time I've stayed Orthodox, I've chosen that. And I have chosen it in a spirit often of being the punishment, right? Or saying, I'm going to be the thorn in your side. I'm going to argue with you why your theological position about XYZ is wrong. And I feel okay doing that. But if you are in a position where all that feels like is you're just getting beat up every day and you're getting abused, like, I would never say someone has to stay, but I would say that they have an ally. They have more women who are staying in the church and picking these kinds of fights to have.
That's not what feels like is getting visibility, though. You know, in terms of what's there, especially in light of, and this is the big reason why we're talking today, is this central question of, is it possible to be a liberal woman in the United States and be religious, not just Orthodox? I mean, we're asking the question from the position of Orthodoxy because you are an Orthodox theologian, because also selfishly on my end, I was raised Orthodox Christian. Mm-hmm. And also we have become, oddly enough, part of this national discussion. Because of all of these converts that have come in.
Yes, and mainly male converts.
Exactly.
And men often in the alt-right pipeline in some way, or who are nationalists, things like that, just to kind of give context. It's not just like a bunch of men are joining. It's a very specific type of men. And Orthodoxy for them has been painted as a masculine religion. Because what's more masculine than the ascetic journey of just putting your all into it, right? Like, they treat asceticism, which is the spiritual exercises, ascesis, asceticism literally means exercises. They treat the spiritual life of the church, which has exercises as part of it, that might be fasting, that might be a prayer life, a spiritual life, that might be physical movements you do during prayer, like prostrations for people who are able to do them or want to do them, etc., right? They kind of take that almost like a bodybuilder would take a, like, their training regimen, which is like, super seriously, I'm a man, I'm going to take my steroids. There's a sort of performative, like, masculinity to the, again, the performance of asceticism. And we see this in, like, one of the major male convert, like, YouTube people, is this guy, Father Moses. Oh, I can look his name up. So it's Father Moses McPherson. He's a bodybuilder, and he's got a lot of videos where he's like one of his videos is priest confronts Catholicism.
What does that mean? Confronts Catholicism.
A day in the life of an Orthodox priest.
Okay.
How to tell if you're demon possessed.
Fun.
Priest confronts Christian avengers and heretics. How a priest treats lust addiction. What? Okay, so, like, that kind of stuff, right? But he had, mm-hmm. like, a hot to holy matrix where it was basically the gist was you want a woman who's, like, hot enough to be attractive to you, but not so hot that there's no way they could be holy. He's also a convert, right? So it's, like, converts being, like, this is my understanding of Orthodoxy and why I joined, and having, like, a confirmation bias, reading everything through that. Because in certain aspects of the church, the missionary impulse is more important than the preserving the tradition impulse.
Although I always understood Orthodoxy not to have a missionary aspect to it, right? Yeah, that we don't go out and proselytize.
Yes, that should be true. But what are these convert dudes doing?
That's true.
You know, so we were at these converts. Mr. Father Moses Bodybuilder.
Yes.
I shouldn't call him that. God bless me, please. I'm sorry. Father Moses McPherson, he is an example of this sort of proselytizing impulse, which is let's like market to a very specific type of dude who feels lost and feels maybe like disaffected from normal society for whatever reason, and then presents this vision of like, well, Orthodoxy is alternative to society. It is different. We reject the world. Like, you can be included here. And all of that is also part of, are you worried that the church is becoming too woke that you're part of? Did your church start ordaining women and you still hate women? Right? They don't say it that way. Mm-hmm. Join Orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is unchanging. Right? Catholics, this will sound familiar to you. Protestants who are part of denominations where these are hot button issues and schisms are happening, this will sound familiar to you, right? That, oh, this church wants to allow openly queer people and this part of my church doesn't, and now we're in a fight. Everything is splitting along these hot button issues. Although how women is still a hot button issue is, it's not beyond me, but I want it to be beyond me. And also, we're women. It's not beyond us. We get it. So how does the alternative witness of women working and fighting in the church, how that is happening at the same time that this proliferation of a certain type of male convert is happening?
Right.
Right. And I actually see them as somewhat linked, which is that women, many cradle women especially, who are part of the American diaspora, or maybe they're OCA, which is Orthodox Church in America. So maybe they're not even part of a diaspora community, but they're cradle born or raised Orthodox from an early age. Also raised in the U.S., being taught in school, like, you're a badass, like, you can be a leader. The sentiment for the purpose of this conversation is, you can be whatever you want. You could be an astronaut. You can do anything. Then they go to church, but you can't go in the altar, you know? And then you go to church, but you can't sit on the right side. In some ethnic communities, not all of them. Or you can't walk in here without a headscarf. Or you can't walk in here without your shoulders covered.
Or with a skirt that short.
Or a skirt that short. Or God forbid if you do, everybody talks about you behind your back. But by the way, you're supposed to find a husband here. But if you attract him too much, that's bad. If you don't attract him at all, also bad. But we're raised with some feminist lens. Even those women who reject feminism, their ability to get online and reject feminism and have a bank account that's their own that they're making money off of in their anti-feminist rhetoric is because of feminism, right? So let's acknowledge that's happening, whether it's to the extent we want or to more of an extent than some people want, right? That's still a lens by which women are acculturated or socialized. So at the same time, you have these guys who are like, oh, I can't be a loser anymore. Women can survive without me. Like, I can't just ask her what she brings to the table.
Yeah.
I have to bring something to the table. And now she actually has her own table and chairs, and I have to figure out what that means. And at the same time, we have way differing moralities, traditional, progressive. We see that sometimes liberation swings so far one way that it becomes oppressive, right? If you are trying to figure out your morality, good luck. I mean, it's hard. It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
And people want to feel safe.
Yeah.
And so these men are like, well, this is what I think is right. And people are telling me I'm not allowed to be a man. I'm not allowed to da 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 da. That's how they're perceiving the conversation. And someone Orthodox and making videos can easily come and say, you want something where we'll tell you what to do and it never changes. And actually the process of doing what you're told is super masculine. And you'll definitely find a wife because you'll be able to go to like Eastern Europe and get one, which is its own problem. There's all sorts of questions around that. Mm-hmm. So you're a dude and you're like in crisis. But the crisis is often the same exact thing that's liberating women.
Hmm.
Like women's liberation is the crisis. Queer liberation is the crisis. So you have women raised in the church who are like, what's going on in the church is really frustrating me because I've been taught this whole other thing. And you, church, have taught me that I'm equal to men. What's going on here? And then certain types of men are being socialized. Like, everything's confusing. Women hate you. You need to be a real man. And some circles of the church are saying to them, we're a place where you can scratch all those itches. So now you have these two confluences merging, which is, many ethnic parishes are not getting as many converts as like the OCA. And they're like, oh, should we do things that the OCA is doing? And then women who are like born into those churches are like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't pander. And so these things are kind of happening at the same time because they're actually products of whether or not you take social change as liberation or something that's causing you a lot of fear and distress. And then on top of it, in the ethnic churches, what happened to ethnic Orthodox churches? We were under colonial rule in the Byzantine East and then under communist rule in the Slavic churches. So what happens? You've ever experienced, you know, a wound. I cut myself. I put a Band-Aid on it. Maybe one day I decide, okay, I take the Band-Aid off, but I'm not like, I'm still being careful. I'm not like getting a tattoo over my cut. If I am touching raw chicken, I put a glove on, right? I'm taking care of it by isolating it. If you're a tradition that's been through a deep wound, like colonization, like oppressive rule, that is a deep wound. To have that many people in your community murdered is a wound. And so what do you do with a wound? You say, I'm going to protect. I'm going to look inward. And so what happens is these mostly ethnic churches are like, our job with Orthodoxy is to make sure it's not illegal again, that we preserve the traditions we have, that in places where traditions were lost, we try to recover them, that we really lean hard into what we've been passed down. Even if the thing that's been passed down was actually a product of a culture and not just Orthodoxy forever, it was just like a thing a local village did in a local time. Now it gets passed down as if it's got the importance of forever, and it may not, but that doesn't matter because we're trying to preserve in the face of a wound. I think that the generation of theologians, maybe one before me and mine, that we are some of the first ethnically based Orthodox theologians who feel like playing with Orthodoxy is not an existential threat to it. Those who came out of Ottoman rule and communist rule, often their books, when you read them, are like, what is Orthodoxy?
Mm-hmm.
What is our faith? What does our faith say about X? What does our faith say about Y? Now you can get a book like this beautiful book here, Ashley Purpura, her book, Women in the Orthodox Tradition, Faith, Feminism, Theology, and Equality, where she's going to take our tradition and do constructive feminist moves with it. And that doesn't feel to her like she's breaking God, right? You have Carrie Frederick Frost, who the book I have that I could find of hers today, even though I have, Carrie, I have all your books if you listen to this, The Reception of the Holy and Great Council, Reflections of Orthodox Christian Women. So she's responding in 2016, there was a council of most of the Orthodox churches of the world, And she said, well, no, women were invited. So invited women to do reflections on them. And some of them are the Changeless Church in the Age of Change.org. Things like Women in the Church, What Our Youth Want to Know. So women are writing these things. And Dr. Frederick Frost doesn't think she's going to break the council. She's not like, oh, if I write this, somehow the Holy Council will fall apart. Dr. Purpura, she's not like, oh, if I write about theologies, I break God. She's like, no, you really can't break God. You know, like, that's not how this works. So at the same time that much of masculine, quote unquote, cultural signifiers are becoming seen as not okay and villainized, is the same time that groups of theologians for the first time feel like we can play with our theology and it's not going to damage it. But if you're a convert and you join the church because it's unchanging, and now some woman theologian comes in and says, no, it's been changing the whole time, and here's changes I think we should make, it's a big clash. And so what I think the hopeful place is, well, I'll stop there because I want to hear your response to that.
Well, I wanted to say, as we were starting to go after these en masse ortho bros, that earlier in my life, I've encountered a couple of converts, men. They always came through because, in a way, yes, an attraction to tradition, but also they were scholarly. Two of them were actually brought into the church because of women, because they had a crush on or were dating a woman who happened to be cradle Orthodox. And so that brought them into the service. And they were like, hang on a second, I'm actually really interested in this. And one of them is a very, very good friend. And to me, they represent someone coming in with individual discernment.
And I should say, like, my conversation is really about the ortho bro thing.
Yeah.
There are lots of men who convert who it's beautiful. Like, when I taught catechism, I had these male convert friends who they were really discerning. To your point, they were saying, I'm Catholic and I have this theological issue, and I would start to roll my eyes. And this is indicting myself. I want to be clear. I would be like, oh, of course, it's women stuff. It's LGBTQ stuff. And it would be something like, one of the people I'm thinking of is from Africa, mm-hmm. a black man from Africa. And he goes, I just don't like the colonial legacy. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's valid. Okay. Right? Like, Ethiopian Orthodoxy is indigenous to Ethiopia. And that matters. And so rolling my eyes, that wasn't good of me. So it's not to say that anytime you see like a male convert to Orthodoxy or Catholicism, that they're in this. It's when you start to hear, well, but I joined Orthodoxy because it's masculine.
Right.
Or like, listeners, I don't want to say that this is all converts, all male converts, even all converts who come via ortho bro. There is a transformative power of the church. There truly is a transformative power of the church. Where, I mean, when I was teaching catechism, I had someone come to me in crisis and say, mm-hmm. I really have to rethink being a Republican. And it wasn't that they were like, I have to become a Democrat. And it's not that I was indoctrinating them. I literally just teach the church councils, right? And they were just like, I'm realizing that some of the ways I understood how welfare should function, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, or poverty, like the solution to poverty is self-sufficiency, or all those things are just not orthodox modes of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I have to rethink about my relationship to those kinds of policies. And he's like, and that's hard. And like, that is hard. And my job in that position is to go to communion with this guy, is to hang out with him and his family because we're friends, mm-hmm. is to be like, hey, like, do you want to grab coffee? Like, right, that's all part of it. Just to be in community.
Being in community and being the living example. It's not, when I said earlier, I'm like, wait a second, I was pretty sure we didn't proselytize, but the other side of it is living through example.
Is living
and
through example.
Showing people, yep. of like, okay, you come alongside that and someone's like, oh, that's interesting, or maybe I should think about this differently. And also you think about people converting, and I think this is part of the big problem with the Ortho Bros, aside from this distorted version of Orthodoxy being presented online, is that they are not being transformed while entering into the religion. Mm-hmm. And now it feels like there is an existential question for the church. If you have so many people at the same time, it's like I mentioned earlier in the conversation, I lived in Istanbul for a while. And so I studied, well, how did this city go from being 1 million people in the 1950s, 100,000 of which were Greek, mostly ethnic native Greeks to there, some of them from Greece, but a lot of them from Asia Minor. And that was one of the minority groups. But how do you go from that and that particular cultural expression to what it is today, over 18 million people, the most Kurdish populated city in the whole of Turkey? There's a big cultural transformation that happens from 1950s to 2010s, 2020s. Well, you have all these people that move en masse, actually, in the 60s, 70s, 80s to Istanbul, whole villages. And so those groups migrating there en masse fundamentally changes the culture of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so you change from this one type of cosmopolitanism to something that's more representative of Turkey as a whole, and actually a city that is quite conservative. So I would liken it in the same way of seeing these big groups en masse coming into the church. You cannot not be affected, and especially from what I understand, that the church is not formally prepared to accept so many people at the same time. So in this environment, and then you have, again, like you say, the cradle women, and we have been raised in the United States with American feminism, with all of these other ideas, and also with what the church tells us about equality. That's, again, the central question of, so how can a woman be even in the church at this point?
Yeah, and it feels also like, who's going to win, right?
Right.
And it shouldn't feel like a war.
I was going to say, it shouldn't feel like someone's winning and losing,
but it,
right?
It does feel that way sometimes, and I feel like really outnumbered or alone,
uh-huh.
or the priests will be like, no, we just want to welcome everybody. And I'm like, you are potentially welcoming nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
You are potentially welcoming fascism. You are welcoming people who would have, if it was 100 years ago, killed Greeks. We should be careful about that, right? And who today would probably kill Black people, and we should be careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not probably, but some of whom might be okay with policies that would do that.
Right.
And our church is not ready to catechize this many people. It is not ready to think about catechism, the social aspects of catechism. I remember going up to the catechumens, and a bunch of them were sitting in the back, and I went up to them and I said, you're catechumens, you should go sit in the front because you should see what's going on. And they were like, well, we don't want to sit in the front. And I said, well, it's not a democracy. Go in the front. I'm your teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to see this. First of all, as an American, that was hard. Like, as a woman, someone socialized as a woman, it was hard to be like that. I didn't want to be authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
But in a Greek parish, if a yaya comes up to you and tells you to uncross your legs.
Oh, you do it.
You do that. It. And, like, listeners, this is a thing. Like, crossing your legs in an Orthodox church, it's just a thing. You're not supposed to do it. It's like, I think it's seen as too casual. I've heard like 85 explanations for this. I'm literally getting a PhD in theology. I have asked so many people this and get a different reason every time. It's just a thing. You don't cross your legs. And it's a thing that grandmas kind of police. So they come up to you and they like tap your leg. Don't cross your legs. Right. And you just uncross them.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a big deal. And
you
so
do.
I had this weird moment where I realized one day actually that everyone is crossing their legs. And I was like, I'm kind of scandalized. And I kind of had this impulse to go around and be like, don't cross your legs. And I did. And they were all like, but I want to cross my legs. And I was like, just don't do it. It's just not an Orthodox thing. But the uncomfortability to give and receive feedback about mm-hmm. what Orthodox culture is another problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we're so happy to have a convert that we don't tell them, hey, by the way, like, this is part of our culture around this. So when we bifurcate ourselves and we don't give feedback and we say it's okay to do the church stuff and not anything else, or you don't need to know the different cultural practices, we are uncomfortable as a church teaching and guiding converts. We're actually uncomfortable telling someone you should do this because this is what orthodoxy is. But what we are comfortable is telling women who are like, hey, isn't this the theology of the church? Well, we don't do that. You know, it's like in the priorities, these male converts often feel like more of a priority than the women who are leaving. Dr. Carrie Frederick Frost says there's a silent schism.
Really?
Because women are leaving in mass silently over these kinds of issues. We're uncomfortable saying to people joining us, don't cross your legs. And maybe that's a bad example. I haven't unpacked my feeling about leg crossing. What I have unpacked my feelings about is if I'm a woman theologian cradle-born and you're a convert and I'm like, hey, we don't cross our leg in church, that even if you want to go like boo-hoo to the priest afterward, in the moment you should uncross your legs. It's like we're uncomfortable adjudicating that conversation unless someone is talking about opening the church up to some kind of liberation. Hey, why can't an openly gay couple get a blessing? Or why can't a woman become a deaconess? There's nothing that bars women from ordination to the diaconate in the Orthodox Church.
Right. And you're part of this organization that's exploring that?
I was on the board of the St. Phoebe Center for the deaconess. And then I was part of Oxia Women. Both are women's organizations in the Orthodox Church.
And it's been a question for a while. I mean, I remember hearing, I must have been a kid when I heard about the possibility of women becoming deaconesses.
It's been like over 100 years.
It seems to be going nowhere, at least from the outside. It seems to be going nowhere.
It's worse now than it was 30 years ago because of all the converts. And so we cannot see preserving the church by just having a bunch of people come in and telling them nothing changes. That's not preserving the church. Like, we're going to continue to have schism. Queer people will leave. Women will leave. People who have daughters will leave because just preemptively, I think about that. Will I raise my daughter Orthodox? I'm an Orthodox theologian, and I grapple with that question. You know, I've presented a pretty negative picture. But what I'll say is there's a lot of hope. I think the fundamental answer to the question, can you be a liberal woman and be a Christian? Yes. Can you be a liberal progressive woman and be Orthodox? Yes. Can you maybe find more home in a different Christian tradition? Also, yes. But I think many folks who are Greek, Russian, Romanian, Bulgarian, who were raised Orthodox as part of their culture, can you ever leave?
I don't think so, personally.
You can't. That's the thing. I sometimes go to Quaker meeting, which is like the Quaker service with my partner. Sometimes I'll say, like, do you like it? What do you think? And I always tell him, like, in the least insulting way I can mean this. It's like sustaining the way chicken broth is.
Okay.
Whereas Orthodoxy will always be like a hearty chicken noodle soup.
Mm.
Like, I am happy to go to Quaker meeting and still get spiritual sustenance. Especially if I'm feeling a little nauseous about Orthodoxy. The worst thing is to have some soup that is a little too filling. I go to Quaker service and get broth and it's actually more healing. But at the end of the day, I still have to get back to the sustaining hearty soup because I can't actually leave it.
Why do you think you keep going back, even though with like all the difficulties and challenges you've described with everything you've shared with me today?
My mentor is this woman, Dr. Mary Hunt, who is a Catholic feminist theologian. And she shared the story with me that when Gloria Steinem turned 80, everybody said to her, how do you look so great at 80? And Gloria Steinem answered, this is what 80 looks like. And then the same thing when she turned like 85. It was like, how do you look so great at 85? And she's like, this is what 85 looks like. And that's the answer. The answer is I'm still what Orthodoxy looks like. I am an openly queer, progressive woman who is Orthodox. And no one can take that away from me. And I refuse to deny the communion which God gives us in becoming incarnate. God said, I'm actually going to be in such radical communion with you that I bridge that divide. That I say, I'm going to be radically you. I'm going to be in communion such that I literally become created. I become finite. I become able to die. Right? I become all those things. Why would I choose anything less than radical communion and community that bridges divides that seem unbridgeable in my irreducible uniqueness? Staying Orthodox is one of the most radical acts of love I can do for myself, but that I can do for others, and that with others, not even for, that I can do in a community. And I totally get for people who are like, this feels abusive, this feels too much. They can leave, they should leave. But the way I see it is, if I can be a hand holding your hand, even if it's literally my little pinkies out and their little pinkies out and they're just touching and they're like, okay, I get my little bit of Orthodoxy. And I feel a little more full from that. That's good enough for me. So for me, part of our progressive movement has to be the acknowledgement that working towards something is enough, even imperfectly, even with people who frustrate us, even in multiple iterations. There's a couple people just from the progressive movement that really inspired me. One is Saul Alinsky. He says, community organizing is like climbing a mountain with a group of people, hitting the peak and realizing there's another mountain. Or in this book, Joyful Militancy, they say we have to be militant in our work. And at the same time, we can't be so militant that we don't leave room for space for becoming more of who you are, which is what they define joy as. I love the idea that in Orthodoxy, even in women's movements, I work with people who genuinely frustrate me, who I think like really like, sometimes I'm like, you're bringing us back. And then I get to have a conversation with them, or I go to communion with them, or I go to a service with them, and we become closer, and actually we both change, and we both become more of who we are, and actually tend to get more aligned as time goes on, as the co-working happens. And the real work of community is to say that our disagreement is the starting place of deeper love, but it also means that sometimes in this church, you need rest, sometimes you need a break, sometimes you need, you know, you need to find community. My spiritual mother is obviously is a spiritual mother. I have a spiritual father as well, but I have a spiritual mother. I know women chaplains. I am part of women's groups. So that when I just need to like scream at someone and be like, that's so annoying. Did you hear what that bishop said? I do have that, right? But I also am the type of person who will straight up write a bishop a letter. Like one time a bishop called a bunch of women in a room delusional, and he didn't mean it that way, but like he did say it, and I wrote him a letter and I was like, you literally studied bioethics and should know what that word means to women in the medical field, so you should have known what it meant for you to say it as a bishop. Do better. And he wrote me an apology. He was like, yeah, I should have known better. Like, to his credit. So rather than being like, that was the starting place of division, I'm never going to talk to this bishop again, I said, can we have it be the starting place of communion? It doesn't always work out. Sometimes they don't write you back. Sometimes they say, like, stay in your freaking lane. How dare you talk to me that way? No, how dare I talk to you that way? I'm an equal member of the body of Christ, so I'm going to keep talking to you this way. But what I would encourage women to do is to take the space they need, take the time they need, seek community, but also don't let other people take this from you. If you step away because it's what you need, you should still seek out the community that you want within it, even if you say, I can't formally be a part of it. But I don't think that we should be letting these folks take something away from us that sustains us, that makes us feel at its best, really good and really like the image of God. Like, why am I going to let an ortho bro take that away from me? So I hope it doesn't sound all doom and gloom.
I think there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but that's what the podcast is about, of looking at the doom and gloom and seeing where it's possible to have hope and where it's possible to be curious about what's happening. Because, you know, I personally believe that hope isn't us blindly saying, oh, well, I hope it'll work out, and burying your head in the sand. I think it's honestly looking at these issues, seeing where they are and seeing what the cracks are in between. We can say, well, here's the way forward. I think that's the other thing, right, about hope, of it's that we're not powerless. And even if it's in a small way that we're doing something different, even if we don't get a response, like it's been sometimes with those bishops you've written to and said, hey, that was not okay. We are not powerless. And so that's huge.
Yeah. And like, if in Paul's letter on love, when he says love is patient, love is kind, those are all participles. So it's actually love is patiencing. Hmm. Love is kinding. In English, you would say love practices patience. Love practices kindness. And so I tend to think that the best thing we can do is just focus on the practices we're going to do. Hope practices speaking up. Hope practices seeing the best in someone. Hope practices having communities we can vent to. Hope practices having communities we can work in coalition with. Hope practices stepping away when we need to. And hope practices stepping in when we need to. And that all of those are practices, not just feelings. Like, I can feel hopeless and still practice hope. And I think that's like what I would want people to take away.
Well, thank you for everything today. I always ask guests at the end to recommend books or resources. So if someone wanted to learn more about Orthodoxy, as well as about women in the church, what would you recommend they read or listen to or watch?
Well, read Ashley Purpura's book, Women in the Orthodox Tradition, Feminism, Theology, and Equality. This is not specific to Orthodoxy, but this book, it's called Intersectional Theology, An Introductory Guide by Grace G. Soon Kim and Susan M. Shaw. It's very easy to read.
Very thin for anyone who can't see
it. Very thin. It's a beautifully written book. And I think for folks who struggle with these kinds of issues that we're talking about, it just brings a lot of vocabulary. Ashley's book's going to also give vocabulary and hope. I would say Carrie Frederick Frost, Church of Our Granddaughters, is a really great book. She also has a book called The Maternal Body. In terms of blogs, I would definitely follow St. Phoebe Center and listen to their webinars. I would follow Oxia Women and go to their stuff, whether it's a webinar or the blog. And then there's an awesome Substack called The Orthodox Feminist, written by Catherine McCord.
Okay.
And then I would also look at folks like on the Oriental Orthodox side. So we talked about Eastern Orthodoxy today. Oriental Orthodox, they call themselves that. Listener, it's a technical term. Phoebe Farag is amazing. She writes on like Orthodoxy and spirituality. Oh, following Sarah Riccardi Schwartz, she focuses really on the convert thing. Hmm. So she has a book called Between Heaven and Russia.
Okay.
And she went to a monastery that was mostly converts, a Russian monastery, and she basically like lived there and looked at the ways that they had, like, for example, they had national ties to Russia. One guy had the icon of Christ and a picture of Putin. And she explores radical alt-right orthodoxy and this kind of ortho-bro thing. So those are all the folks I would say. And then the other thing is just beyond reading, reach out to these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's okay if you reach out to me. It's okay if you find someone's academic email. Academics take a long time to respond, but we will. And, you know, reach out to Oxia Women and be like, I want this webinar and I can't afford the $5. Can I still join? Like, ask those kinds of questions. Be part of those communities, because the real lived piece with the reading is what the magic sauce, you know, not just kind of reading. And then what? You get frustrated and you're like, oh, I know the term patriarchally limited. Great. Like, you just feel worse.
Yeah.
You know, have that community, I would say, too.
Thank you again, Rachel, for this discussion. I've come out feeling really proud of all the female theologians she mentioned during our interview, and also like I've got some reading to do. I'm not saying this is sparking a religious revival, but I feel really connected to what Rachel said, especially about being the punishment. I might change her phrasing a bit and say, let me be the medicine instead. But it reminds me of one of the aspects of Orthodox Christianity that I grew up with and that I still live by, that I was given certain gifts and abilities. According to what I grew up with in the church, it's my duty to use them. And this reminds me quite a lot, actually, of our first episode of our Pandora's Box, where I talk about my life purpose. And those gifts of being able to hear other people's stories and show people what matters extends to being the medicine for the wrongs I see around me. And being the medicine means also speaking up when I see a wrong, just like Rachel. I want to leave you with another thought today. A question, actually. What are the ways you practice hope? Take a few minutes after you finish the episode and jot them down. They don't have to be in sentences. Just think about it. Write whatever comes to mind. And then the next time you're faced with a situation or an article that pisses you off or makes you feel hopeless or powerless, I want you to look at that list. And then go out there and put one of those ways of hope into action. Thank you for listening to this episode of Our Pandora's Box. If you liked this one and are looking for more conversations about how to be a woman in the world right now, check out our previous interviews with experts in values-based careers, equal pay. For easy links to the books and resources Rachel mentioned, click on the link in the show notes for the Our Pandora's Box Substack, where you can also continue the conversation. Our Pandora's Box is a Pentelic Productions podcast that was created, hosted, produced, and edited by yours truly, Maria Iliadis. Thanks again for joining us. And remember to stay hopeful and stay curious. I'll see you soon on the next Our Pandora's Box.